Because we live in a Puritan police state, we are obliged to inform you that we may sometimes use explicit language. Now that you've been informed, things are about to get weird.
Welcome to the What I Had Heard Was Midnight Edition. I am Jennifer.
And I'm Anna.
And I'm Diane.
And today we are talking about crimes that inspired movies.
I have the giggles.
Excellent.
Which is not appropriate at all.
I think it's a perfect time. You're not at a funeral, so.
I was just thinking, wouldn't it be funny if I was still on mute and then I tried to talk? Like everybody is in these times.
Sure. Well, I'm sure if we were on a Zoom or something, I'd be a potato or a cat or something, so.
Was that not the funniest video? Of the attorney stuck as a cat. I am not a cat.
Obviously. Yeah, apparently there was another one where a guy was on a Zoom and he was upside down.
Oh, oops.
And he couldn't figure out how to flip himself back around.
It sounds like me trying to do anything.
Yeah, it was another government official.
So that's cool. Defies gravity.
You could turn that into a Broadway musical.
There you go. After 2020, I expect anything to happen.
The government official defying gravity is the musical?
Yeah.
Okay. starring Kristen Chenoweth.
Exactly.
As gravity. Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, anything can inspire art. Art begets art, right? Much like our current subject matter for this podcast.
Wait, I want to see how you're going to tie this together.
Flawless segue. I'm ready for it.
Yeah. Well, people are intrigued by news, by scandal, by things that are out of the ordinary. And what's more out of the ordinary? Murder. The most out of the ordinary thing. We hear about it a lot, but that's because it honestly doesn't happen very often compared to all of the other moments in your life, you know?
That's right. You can only get murdered once.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a finite number of times you can murder somebody. Actually, that's probably a whole different podcast. People who've survived murders.
Oh, God.
Anywho's. But for this podcast, we're talking about crimes and murders that have inspired movies and books and plays and whatnot.
Absolutely.
Well, that was a good segue.
It was a little roundabout, but it got there. So the guy I'm talking about is the most famous of these inspirations, one Mr. Ed Gein.
Oh, Ed.
Mm-hmm. He has inspired several books and movies and television shows, band names, songs, entire albums.
Fashion.
Fashion, unfortunately.
But.
Yeah, interior decorating. Yeah, yeah.
I'm pretty sure TLC is going to have, you know, had a whole little spinoff for that. A couple years after all of his most famous incident happened is when the book Psycho was written, and then a year later the movie came out. Silence of the Lambs, their main character, Buffalo Bill, was inspired by him. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, because, you know, Ed Gein was the original Leatherface. It goes on. Rob Zombie would probably not have a career if it wasn't for Ed Gein. Well, he probably would. He's still a pretty good singer, but his whole oeuvre.
His whole what?
Oeuvre. his je ne sais quoi. His style. His thing.
His M.O. Like his.
There it is. Yep, his M.O.
Yeah.
His operandi. Yep, we're getting there.
I didn't know that that's what that stood for either.
Hey, yeah, we'll all see. Learning today.
It's beautiful.
Can you insert like a "the more you know" rainbow right there?
There you go.
Yeah.
Is that?
The more you know.
Thank you.
So, unsurprisingly, like many other murderers and sociopaths, he had an abusive childhood. He was born in 1906, and his father was an alcoholic, so which meant that he was just kind of in and out of paying attention to his family. He, you know, was passed out a lot, not around, etc. So Ed's mom was the one who raised him and his old brother Henry. His mother, Augusta, was the driving influence of his life, but she was very, very strict, very punitive. She was very religious, and she would, you know, quote Bible stuff to him all the time, read Revelations, a lot of Old Testament type of stuff, fire and brimstone, divine retribution, and all the earthly sins. And basically, every other woman in the whole world, except for herself, was of the devil and was just there to basically tempt her sons and bring their souls to hell.
That's what I teach my sons.
We should talk after this. Anytime the boys would try to make any friends, they'd be punished and further isolated. They grew up basically on a farm, a 155-acre farm near Plainsville, Wisconsin. So the only time the boys were allowed to leave the farm was to go to school. And that's it. So, needless to say, Ed had extremely poor social skills.
Mama Gein wasn't having it.
Not at all. Not at all.
I feel bad for him.
I know, right? Like, he probably could have been fine. Because that's the thing. Like, the people who knew him, you know, because, I mean, he still, you know, would talk to people at work and at school. And, you know, and the teachers all said, you know, he was nice. He was a little awkward, a little weird, but he did surprisingly well in his studies. He was an avid reader. He was very quiet. So it's not like he would have, you know, crazy outbursts or anything. But yeah, so his mom was his best friend, you know. 1940 is when Ed's life starts to kind of unravel. He's 34 by this time. And his father dies from heart failure due to alcoholism, right? So he and his older brother take on odd jobs to help their mother with the farm, to keep things going.
How old are they at this point?
Ed's 34 and his brother Henry's 38.
And they've always been on the farm?
Yep.
Okay.
Lived on the farm. They had various jobs. So they met people and interacted with people through that. But nothing was, you know, standard 9-to-5 company man kind of work.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Henry was able to kind of break free and meets up with a divorcee and her two kids. They kind of fall in love, have a thing. So he's like, hey, I'm going to go move in with her, live my own life. Ed, you should run. You should really run because mom's crazy pants. And she's just been, you know, psychologically and emotionally abusing us our whole lives. You need to run.
So how does he figure this out? Like, his girlfriend tells him? I mean, or he knew this the whole time, and then finally he's like, when he's 40 years old, he leaves?
Well, yeah, I guess so. I didn't really look into Henry that much.
It's just curious that you would, like, by 40, you're like, oh, now I realize mom's insane. Like, you didn't realize...
Well, Sorry. No. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Just you didn't realize that the other 38 and a half years you were there.
I mean, I'm sure he realized it sooner in life, but, you know, sometimes it takes a while to flee the nest, you know?
That's what I was going to say. Like, parental grip really gets you sometimes.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is all he's ever known. I'm sure his, you know, their father had just died, and... You know, I'm sure Ed felt responsible now, like, oh, mom's going to be alone. And on it, and if these guys never made other friends out of fear of retribution, apparently Ed took that to heart a lot more than Henry did. And Henry was able to compare his life to the world around him and and get out of there. So, but his freedom didn't last very long, because in 1944, Henry and Ed were out in the acres, trying to do some yard work, burning out vegetation and, you know, just old scrap, whatever. And the fire gets out of control. It becomes such a blaze that they have to call in the fire department. Fire department comes in, helps extinguish the blaze. You know, people are running around, kind of crazy pants, doing whatever. And then all of a sudden, Henry or Ed's like, "Hey, where's Henry?" Reports his brother missing. Now the police department come out. Folks are doing, everybody's doing like an organized search, and then they find Henry on the farm, face down, dead. Apparently, he had been dead for some time, but was not burned. But after autopsies and whatever, they figured that it was some sort of heart disease inspired by asphyxiation. You know, so maybe smoke inhalation, that kind of thing. But because his dad just recently died of heart failure, they're like, okay, fine. It was ruled an accident, and folks moved on. Either way, now it's just Ed and his mom. Soon afterwards, though, she had a stroke. Paralyzing stroke. Paralyzed her, right? So now Ed was just at her side 24/7. If they weren't tied close enough before, now they're like at the wrist, right? A little while afterwards, she had a second stroke, and December 29th of 1945, she passed away. With her death, he had lost his only friend and basically one true love. And he was absolutely, utterly alone now. So within 5 years, he had lost his entire family.
Yeah, that's intense.
Yeah. And for somebody who already, you know, had poor social skills, was isolated, didn't really have another social network to rely on, things kind of snapped.
And at this point, we think the brother died of the fire?
Correct. It was ruled an accident. There were some folks who went back, you know, and looked at things a little. Once people figured out who Ed actually was, they would go back and see other things and look a little harder into cases, etc. So they did find, you know, they went back and looked at the autopsy reports and noticed that there was bruising on Henry's head. But they also just kind of chalked that up to, you know, falling down from asphyxiation, etc. So, but some people speculated that, you know, it was kind of a Abel and Cain kind of biblical thing of, you know, Ed didn't like the fact that Henry was talking bad about mom. You know, who's mom's favorite, et cetera, et cetera. So, but it was all kind of speculation because Ed never admitted to doing anything to Henry.
He admitted to his other crimes?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, well, okay, sorry. You keep going. You keep telling us this so far great story.
Oh, so besides being considered a little odd, folks considered him reliable and quiet and just kind of was living his life. He lived on the farm, got some subsidies, did some odd jobs, whatever, sold off a little bit of land. So Ed was living his life on his little farm, a little oddball, but things are seeming pretty normal, right? Until November 16th, 1957. The local hardware store owner, Bernice Warden, goes missing, right? Her son is the deputy sheriff of the town and goes to the hardware store and finds the register open, blood on the floor, leading out the back door, right? They do a little research. They do a little digging around. They find that the last receipt that she had filled out at the store was for Ed Gein. So they go to his house. They don't find him. They eventually track him down at a grocery store that same day. So they have him arrested. They ask him a couple questions. They go back to his house and they start searching the farm. And then that is when everything just kind of explodes and the world is shook. In the shed, they find Bernice Warden, but she was decapitated and hanging upside down like a dressed out deer.
Oh my goodness gracious.
So, I don't know if y'all have ever hunted deer or seen what a dressed out deer looks like.
Mm-mm.
But basically what you do is you hang a deer upside down so that all the blood will drain out of the body. You take a metal rod and you shove it in between the tendons or between bones in the ankles to spread the legs apart. And so everything hangs out. You stab them in the neck so they can drain all the blood. And you basically gut them straight down the middle, flay everything open so you can remove the guts. So that's how the deputy sheriff, Bernice's son, found his mother. So they go inside looking for her head. Not only did they find her head, they found a whole bunch of other stuff. First off, the house itself, it completely hoarder-ish. Like, if you like watching Hoarders, you're totally going to get off on looking up pictures of this guy's house. It's trashed, things are dilapidated, there's stuff everywhere, there's smells, not a lot of good lighting, just everything is just kind of like, what animal, what filthy, filthy animal is living in this house? Except for Ed's mother's room. Her room was all closed off, but everything in there was beautiful and pristine, just the way she left it the day she died. Right? So it's kind of like a little homage. But looking around the house, besides the fact that it was a filthy hoarder place, they also found Ed had developed a hobby that he actually had learned from his father. His father was one of the many jobs his dad had was as somebody who would tan animal skins for hunters. So he would do that filthy, filthy job. And Ed apparently was very good at it. So much so that he had a waste paper basket made out of human skin. Human skin covered chair seats. A corset made from a female torso. Skinned from the shoulders to the waist. Various face masks. A pair of lips that were the actual window shade drawstrings. Lampshades made from human faces. A belt that was made specifically from nipples. All kinds of just really fucked up things. Skulls on the bedposts, all this kind of stuff, right?
Designs by Ed.
I know, yeah. Like, the he would have taken the fashion world by storm if this had not been people.
Yeah. I don't really have anything to say. It's just fascinating. I just can't. Like, I just want to sit with that for a minute.
Yeah. Upon further inspection, all of the pieces and parts that he had around the house were all from women. Apparently, they were all from women who resembled his mother.
Yeah, well, so, because who wants a dick lamp?
Well.
I don't want a dick lamp. Maybe you do.
Well, I'll be sure to remove that from the guest room when you come to visit.
Dick alarm clock. Dick area rugs. You got the matching set.
I mean, you know.
Spread it out. There's
a lot more phallic artwork going around in the world than there is of the vulva. But
I know. There should be more Georgia O'Keeffe.
Yeah.
The O'Keeffe the shit out of the place. So, yeah. Yeah. Apparently, Ed loved his mother so much that he admitted to saying he wanted to be his mother. He wanted to be so close to her, he wanted to be inside of her. So, he admitted to going to the graveyard and removing bodies of people who had recently passed, and then taking bits and pieces of them, skinning them, making masks, making suits, gloves, leggings, this corset, so that he would closer resemble his mother.
But, like, how come nobody noticed these missing bodies?
Well, he would do it at night, and they were recently buried, so the ground was already kind of dug up, you know? So, funeral happened.
Who knew? All you had to do was go at night.
Yeah. Needless to say, there was lots of questions that the police had. They counted more body parts and things than what he had accounted for. And so besides finding Bernice Warden's entire head in a burlap sack and her heart in a plastic bag in front of Gein's potbelly stove, they found another woman that they could identify, one Mary Hogan. They found her face mask in a paper bag and then her skull in a box.
Because why not?
Yeah. So then that is when Ed admitted that he admitted to shooting Mary, who was the bar owner of one of the places that Ed would frequent. She had been missing for 3 years, so since 1954. But he said that he did not remember the details of her death, because apparently when Ed would go to the graveyards, he would have moments of, as he put it, like a fog or a daze. So he would lose time. He wouldn't remember certain things. He would wake up in places and, you know, like, oh, why am I here? So apparently he went to the graveyard a bunch of different times and kind of snapped out of it before actually doing anything. But with all of this, he was considered mentally incompetent and unfit for trial. Eventually, he was diagnosed as schizophrenic and then was committed to the maximum security Central State Hospital for the Criminally Insane. Okay, so Ed's been in custody for a couple months. March 1958, his house and belongings were put up in auction, and people were really excited about owning a piece of this weirdo, owning a piece of this, like, crazy macabre history. And while some folks were cleaning up the yard and once again, you know, burning some things to try to help clean up the yard, his house accidentally catches on fire. And the fire department was a little slow to get there because Bernice Warden's son was also in charge of the fire department. So folks kind of speculate that he just, you know, quote unquote, let the motherfucker burn.
Mm-hmm.
That was my own quote based off of a song. So
can't say I blame him.
Yeah. So, but his car was purchased, by a carnival sideshow operator, who would charge people 25 cents to see the vehicle that he used to cart around his victims.
Bah, bah, bah. Yeah. I mean, if someone offered you the opportunity to have that nipple belt, would you take it?
Nah.
Well, I mean, it depends on what it would go with, you know. Now,
like what color the nipples were?
Yeah, you know, because, I mean, accessories make the outfit. So those specific items, the Ed Gein specials, those were documented and then, how did they put it? Like, disposed of discreetly? Or buried or, you know, cremated or what have you. So they treated them as deceased people, parts of people. So pictures still exist, but not the actual objects.
I did not know that pictures existed, and now I want to Google them.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, you'll see. And the nipple belt is one of the ones that you can find, FYI. So.
Well, Ed.
Oh my God, I don't know why I didn't think these weren't going to be disturbing. This lamp has hair on it.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, please continue.
So it's 10 years later, it's 1968, and the court ruling that Ed was mentally incompetent and unfit for trial was overturned, based off of various conversations and, you know, treatments with doctors, etc. So, he stood trial for the death of Bernice Warden. He said that he did shoot her. He was in the hardware store, but that he was testing out this new 22 rifle that she was selling. He had loaded it, and it accidentally went off, and he accidentally shot her. Either way, doesn't explain all the shit he did to her afterwards. So he was found guilty and then remanded to spend life in prison in the mental hospital, where he died in 1984 at the age of 77 from lung cancer. So this crazy guy, who basically could have been a person who lived a very normal life if he would have had a friend. You know, I feel like this is socializing with other people and getting different viewpoints in life and expanding your horizons can do so much.
Nature versus nurture.
Exactly. You know, it's like he could have, even with his diagnosis of schizophrenia, you know, there's so many people who are able to live life without skinning people's faces off. But thanks to this crazy story, we've had some wonderful horror movies and lots and lots of nightmares caused because of this one person's messed up life.
This is why I don't want kids. I mean, you could really F them up.
Well, as long as you're not going to, like, lock your kid in the basement naked for 6 months at a time or, like, scald his wiener when he pees the bed, he's probably going to be fine.
Yeah,
now you tell me.
So I'm not going to mess him up when I'm like, hey, how do you pronounce Ed Gein? Go look it up on the Google. And then he finds all these lamps with hair on them. That's great mothering right there.
Well, you know, you have, the thing is, you know, you have to expose people to things so that they learn what not to do, right? I don't know. The problem is like, no matter what you do with your children, you're going to mess them up one way or the other. You know, if you're, oh, I'm going to protect you from everything, but then you're too overprotective and look what happens. Mm-hmm. Or you go, fine, you're on your own, do what you want. And like, oh, you were never around. You know, I had to do everything on my own. And, you know, it's like either you're too soft or you're too hard, you're too nice, you're too mean, you're too, you know, it's like.
The three bears.
Exactly. Right. Yep.
They're making belts out of nipples.
You know, it's,
if you're just talking about making the belts and not actually making them, I think you can still be a good parent.
Yeah. Oh, you're so supportive.
She is. And I have to say, her kids are amazing. So, you know.
And I only made one nipple belt when they were little.
Arts and crafts day.
Speaking of nipple belts.
Yeah.
There's one that I really, really want to talk about. Is it time for me to talk?
It is.
It's always time for you to talk, Diane.
Because I cannot wait to talk with you guys about the Amityville Horror.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one.
Yeah. I feel like the same as you. Like, everybody knows about the Amityville Horror because there was a book and, like, 25 movies about it.
One of which has Ryan Reynolds in it, just letting you guys know that.
Yeah, a freaking hot Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's like before he was like kind of, I don't want to say doughy, but he was like average human being, right? Mm-hmm. And then he got ripped for this and everybody was like, oh, hello, Ryan. You know?
Hello.
Well, yeah, to like, kill your whole family, you have to be ripped.
Right? Yeah, you do.
It makes it easier.
So, the original movie was in 1979.
Who had a hottie in that one as well, one Mr. James Brolin.
Yeah, and Margot Kidder.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Both very good-looking people. So, and then there was a whole bunch of movies in between and after and all of that. But that 1979 movie was based off of a book that was commissioned or written by the people who actually lived in the house. Well, the second family. Okay, so let me get into it, okay? Or let me start telling you the story.
I'm here for it.
Do it. I got popcorn and everything. Let's do this.
Okay, good. And I want you guys to talk about it too with me, because one of the main reasons why I'm on this show is because, or this podcast, is because I love talking with you guys. So I wanted to mention the facts that came from a website called Fancy Pants Homes.
And Fancy Pants Homes?
Yeah. So I could have taken facts from anywhere because it's like so popular, but I really wanted to take it from that one.
I like it.
Anyway. So the Amityville Horror House is about a house in Amityville, New York.
Where horror happened.
Where horror happened in a house. And Amityville is in Long Island, New York. And this family built it in 1924. They don't have much to do with the story. Their last name is Moynihan, like Bobby Moynihan.
Oh, God, I fucking love Drunk Uncle. Can I just tell you how much I love that man so much?
It's good. It's good.
So good.
The Saturday Night Live sketch.
Yes.
So anyway, it was built in 1924, and then in 1965, the DeFeos bought it. And the DeFeos were this Italian family from Brooklyn, and they came in. They had 7 people in their family. So they had the mom and the dad, and then the 5 children. The oldest son's name was Butch or Ronnie. It was interchangeable.
And much like any Chekhov play. It's like everybody has 4 names.
Right, right. Then they had an 18-year-old daughter, a 13-year-old daughter, a 12-year-old son, and then a 9-year-old son. But the oldest son, they said, was like, they basically said he was a troubled youth, you know, this son, Ronnie.
Aren't we all?
Yeah. And he was 23 when this happened. So on November 13th, we have these November stories so far. November 13th, 3:00 in the morning, Ronnie runs into town and he says, "Hey, everyone, somebody broke into my house and killed my entire family."
Shit.
So everyone runs back to the house and looks and sees the entire family face down on the floor with in their own respective rooms with gunshot wounds and had been murdered that way. So Ronnie claims that a stranger broke into their house and murdered the family, and people think that maybe it was because their family could have had this like mafia connection, because they're Italians from Brooklyn. Not to say there's any mafia Italian.
Ah, good old fashioned racism. That's nice.
Yeah, but very soon after he makes this claim, he confesses to murdering his entire family. With a .35 caliber rifle. He says that he murdered them all because a voice told him to do it. So
must be demonic.
Right. Well, I've seen different sort. I've seen different things. That the voice was from God. That the voice was actually a demon. That it was a schizophrenic voice. Anyway,
well, I mean, if we're playing 1, 2, 3 or ABC, I think only one of those would be logical.
Right, right.
The demon, obviously.
Obviously.
Right?
Okay. Obviously. I've seen Insidious. So here we are. The whole 6 other people in his family have been murdered in the house by the son, the oldest son, and he's confessed that he's done it because of a voice that told him to do it. He goes to trial, he gets convicted of murder and is sentenced to several life sentences. So he's still in prison today.
Right now?
As far as I know.
I thought he died. Maybe I made that up. I got distracted thinking about potatoes.
Well, maybe the articles that I looked at weren't
He's alive. He's 69. So you are correct.
69, dude.
Ronald, Ronnie, Butch, DeFeo's now in jail for these murders. And about a year goes by, the house is up for sale, and this other couple buys it. Their name is George and Kathy Lutz. And this is where things start to pick up. They haven't already. You haven't found it exciting already. I know this is a roller coaster, so hang on. George and Kathy Lutz buy it because they say that it's like a financial steal. It has all the amenities that they want. So even though they know that there had been a murder there very shortly before they were offered the house, they took it anyway. So that, I guess that's important to know about them, that they did have an awareness of what had happened there beforehand. So they buy the house, and then in 28 days, they leave. They leave all of their things. They just totally abandon the house and never go back. The reason why they do this is because they, over the first 28 days there, they say that they experience like the most crazy things you have ever heard. They say that they hear, well, first they have a priest come and bless the house, and the priest says that he hears something, like just this voice say to him to get out of the house.
That's never a good sign.
Yeah. Then they said that, like, their kid saw this, like, apparition. They said there's green slime. They saw, like, running down the walls.
Good Lord. They watched Ghostbusters.
Yeah, it wasn't out yet. That's the thing. It wasn't out yet.
Well, then Slimer came from them. That's, I mean, regardless, right. It's not, none of these claims are like innovative or exciting. They're all, oh, we saw spirits. We heard voices. We got poked in the butt by demons. It's all, we've heard it 500 right. times, you know, and buying right. the house.
We have now, but sure. then all this stuff was new. And we have now because we hear people's retelling of this story. That's the thing. Right. Like, people take this and then it goes off and off and on. You know, it's like the whole get out. You know, all of that is now cliche, but this was the first time any of this stuff had ever happened.
Right.
You mean being a spirit being blamed for murder?
Well, these types of things, I'm sure. I mean, you know, the Salem witch trials, people are blaming spirits for doing all kinds of filthy things for as long as we can remember. But I'm just saying the tropes, the things you're talking about is, you know, oh, they just watched this other movie. They just took this off of this other thing. No, all these other things took it off of them. They were the
but
first.
But there was, prior to this, there was a lot of people who were spiritualists, and the slime, maybe not green, but that whole idea was already out there. There was an idea of what ghosts were and what was good and what was bad. So they didn't come onto the scene totally making everything up. Like, hey, we've invented paranormal here.
Sure. But I would say it probably wasn't as well known, you know. I mean, either who's. We're both speculating.
The article from Fancy Pants says that George Lutz heard voices, random knocking noises, doors would allegedly slam on their own, and other creepy stuff.
So all of that stuff, I would say, is from seances and, you know, traditional specter type things.
Right. Then it says, it all finally became too much when the walls supposedly started oozing some kind of slimy, green, yucky stuff.
Did they get a sample of this slimy, green, yucky stuff?
I don't know. Egon, your mucus.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, whether that was spectral or not, that's definitely a reason for me to go, yeah, I'm out.
So, yeah, all this stuff happened to them, and they moved out. Although, there is this other sidebar where neighbors said they moved out within 10 days. And so, if you are a, what's that word, skeptic, one of the theories is that they just realized they were in too deep financially. And so they were like, peace out, we're not paying anymore. And they just left. So they left and said the place was possessed or haunted from everything that had happened before. So George and Kathy Lutz wrote a book with their lawyer called The Amityville Horror. And they essentially used it to tell their story about the house and the hauntings that they had experienced. And so many people were saying, again, this was just a way for them to, for a financial gain, because they were in a hole. But they kept denying it. And they even said, like, on George Lutz's deathbed, he said all of those things really happened to him. And in fact, he, like, had this one point where he woke up in the middle of the night and he and his wife were levitating, and they just like looked at each other like, can you effing believe what is happening to us right now? So, but the lawyer said that they made the whole thing up, that they got drunk one night and they just like, they were like, this is how we're going to make money. So I don't know, either way, a book came out in 1979 about it. The book eventually was turned into a movie. The book was in 77, and then the movie came out in 1979, the one with James Brolin, Margot Kidder. And since then, they've just been trying to remake it over and over again. Sequels and remakes and everything else, because it's just such an interesting story that you can do so much artistically with. So, what do you guys think
about the place being haunted?
Oh, I do have one more thing to share. One of the reasons why I chose this topic to talk about was because I have a personal connection with it. And that is, one of my family members grew up in that area. And he said, it's one of my like older uncles, and he said that he knew the family, the DeFeo family, and he said that the Ronnie DeFeo still writes him from prison and says that the reason why he did all this was because he heard that voice. He thinks he was possessed by a demon.
So he still thinks that?
Yep. He still maintains that.
Wow. I feel like you kind of buried the lead on that one.
Yeah. that, huh? Well, because it's like a so-and-so twice removed sort of story. So.
Sure. So that's the thing though. It's like the movies and stuff were made based off of the movies and book were made based off of the experience of the Lutzes.
Right.
The actual, you know, whether you believe their story or not, like the things that actually corroborated were the fact that this guy still killed his family.
Yep.
You know, he still went into the house, shot his mother, father, brothers and sisters, and took a bath, went to work, and was like, hey everybody, the devil made me do it. You know?
Yeah. And you know, there's so many questions, too, about that initial murder. Like, how did no one hear all six shots and run, or five shots, no, six shots, and run over there and, like, try and figure out what was going on? Or, like,
people like to mind their business. You know, a lot of times, unless you have a reason, people just keep to yourself, you know?
Yeah, that definitely could be. But what about the question of if he shot like the first one or two, how did the other four not hear it? Like, how did they end up in their spot still as if they were sleeping?
Well, he could walk them back. If they come and he points a gun at them, they're going to do whatever he says. So he could walk them back into the room one by one and shoot them. What are they going to do?
Okay, so far you've debunked all my questions.
Well, I would say, honestly, okay, so there's six of them, right? They're They're each in their respective rooms. Even if, it's the older brother. Yeah, he was a bad news bears or whatever. But I would say whoever he shot last, like, I would have ran out of that room, at least tried to make a break for it.
Well, if he killed them in order or in the order that they... If he killed the youngest last, she's going to be terrified. What is she going to do? Where is she going to go? And trying to take on somebody who just killed five of your family members. You take the father out first, then you take out the mother, and you go down accordingly.
Sure. My point is, though, it's human nature's a fight or flight, right? So you're obviously youngest one, 9 years old to however old he was. You're not going to fight him, right? But at least you're going to try to hide, try to do something. You're going to, I don't know. I feel like put up a little bit of a struggle, something. But either way, it happened, But why it happened, what caused all this stuff, that's what intrigues us. That's what, that's what keeps us talking about this stuff today, because it's like, it just doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. None of this makes sense.
Well,
they even offered that they could have been drugged, too. Like, he could have put some sort of drug in their stuff so that they... stuff in their stuff.
The thing is, I think it does make sense. It's just gotten the entertainment industry got a hold of it and just ran with it. Somebody decided to lie, and that lie got bigger and bigger and bigger, and now you have what you have. Initially, you have a man who is mentally ill who kills his whole family. He's not the first. He won't be the last. It happens. If you go through other cases, you're going to find similar things where you're going to go, how did this happen? Why didn't anybody come? How did he convince people to do those things? So this isn't the only place that it happens. I think it's just that once the book was written and somebody decided to make money off of it, it became something else entirely. It was no longer about the crime.
Sure. Well, because the book wasn't about the crime. The book was about, the fact that the Lutzes were, quote unquote, the house was possessed. So the Lutzes were the one that expounded. I'm just saying that, even then DeFeo, who's still saying that he heard voices, the devil made him do it kind of a thing. Still a messed up situation. I find a similarity between what you were saying, Jennifer, about how the Lutzes made up this story. And, it became this much larger thing because the story that the Lutzes came up with was far more interesting than the actual DeFeo family murder. I find the similarities in that to the phenomenon of the Slender Man.
Their story never would have been their story would have been nothing had it not been for the murders. So the crime had to be there for them to get the attention that they did. That's my belief.
That the Lutzes got the attention?
That they needed DeFeo to murder his family in order for them to get the attention they needed to sell their story, for it not to be just another ghost story.
Sure, yeah, it gives it plausibility.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally.
So I watched Monster recently, which was Charlize Theron depicting Eileen Wuornos. And I don't know if you've seen this, but she does a spectacular job in this role. It's amazing. Mm. And then today I watched a documentary with the actual Eileen Wuornos, and...
Really?
Yeah, it was kind of creepy, to be honest, because they look so much alike.
Little typecasting?
It was intense. But, so she was born Eileen Carol Pittman, and then Eileen Carol Lee Wuornos. And she was born February 29th, leap year, 1956, in Rochester, Michigan. So her mom was only 14 years old when she married Eileen's father, who was only 16 years old. They were married a little bit less than 2 years, and her mom filed for divorce 2 months before Eileen was born. So, Eileen's born 29th of 56, and her older brother Chris was born March 14th of 1955. And Eileen never got to know her father. He was put in prison before she was born. and he was convicted of sex crimes against children and then subsequently hung himself in his cell. So she never met him.
Jeez.
At some point in time while incarcerated, he was diagnosed with schizophrenia. So following this, in January of 1960, Diane, which is Eileen's mom, she abandons Eileen and Keith with her parents, who are said to be both, were said to be both violent alcoholics. The grandparents adopted both of them in March of 1960, so shortly after, and Warno said that her father's, her, she called her grandfather her father, so her father had sexually assaulted and beaten her when she was a child, and all indications say that that's true. So by the age of 11, she was trading sexual favors for cigarettes and food, drugs, and she was also having sex with her brother. So I think there are some blurred lines here. In 1970, well, I'm sorry.
Yeah, so she just never had a chance.
She never had a chance.
There was no hope for a normal childhood.
And it just got worse for her. It's one of those things where literally nothing ever went her way. And it's sad, you know, to look at her life. What she did wasn't okay, but it's very sad. In 1970, she was 14 years old, and she became pregnant, having been raped by one of her grandfather's friends. So she was sent away. She had a little boy. He was put up for adoption. And after that, she dropped out of school. And at the same time, her grandmother died. She had liver failure. And when Eileen was 15, her grandfather kicked her out of the house. So she was living in the woods, and she was making money by working as a sex worker.
It's the oldest profession.
Mm-hmm. So later on, she had some scuffles with crime, and it, as you would expect someone who has to live a life like that. But she met a woman named Taria Moore, and she was a maid at a hotel in Daytona Beach. It was a lesbian bar, and I think they hit it off right away and moved in together. And Eileen supported them by working on the streets. She referred to herself as a special call girl in court. She only murdered for a period of 12 months, and she managed to murder 7 men in that time. And the first one was Richard Charles Mallory, and he was 51 years old. She made accusations against him, stating that that was self-defense. And between the time that she testified in court and the time she was put to death, she went back and forth on that. She was extremely descriptive on the things he did to her. But it was later, when she was on death row for quite a while and decided she was done, that she recanted those statements and said that she just killed everyone for the purpose of robbery. So I'm not going to recount what her testimony included in the abuse, but if you want to look that up, it's extremely disturbing. And he,
there's some dark rabbit holes that we have created on these most recent podcasts, I'm just saying.
Oh, yeah, and it didn't help, you know. It was more difficult for her to back it up and say, oh, no, he didn't torture and rape me, because he was a convicted rapist. So she was convicted and sentenced to death on Richard Mallory. So right out of the gate, it appeared that she had exceptionally ill-prepared counsel all the way through, which was disappointing. And she made the statement, you just sentenced a raped woman to death. So they have to sit with that. Next, she killed David Andrew Spears, and he was 47. He was a construction worker. They found him naked in Florida in Citrus County, and he'd been shot 6 times by a .22. There was Charles Carskadden, perhaps, and he was 40. He was a part-time rodeo worker. and his body was found in Pasco County. He'd been shot 9 times with a 20 caliber. That's what she did. She was very shooty.
Everybody's got their thing.
Right. We've got Peter Abraham Seams, and he's 60. He was 65, retired merchant seaman. His body was never found. His car was found in Orange Springs. So Taria and Eileen were seen running from that car that belonged to him. There's Troy Burris. He was 50, sausage salesman. What up? And he had been shot twice. Charles Dick Humphrey was 56, and he was a retired U.S. Air Force major. And his body was found fully clothed, and he had been shot 6 times in the head and torso. And finally, there was Walter Antonio, and he was 62. He was a truck driver and actually had quite a few jobs. He was found nearly naked in remote logging road, and he had been shot 4 times.
So basically, within the course of 1 year, she shot all these people.
Correct.
That's crazy.
Jeez.
She had stated that she believed the police knew that she had killed Mallory and let her continue doing it so that they could make money off of her selling the movie rights. And as out there as that sounds, I think that it was based on... she had a reason to believe it. So whether it was true or not, she definitely had a reason to believe that. She was arrested on January 9th, 1991, on an outstanding warrant at the Last Resort, which was a biker bar. And then Taria was arrested the next day in Pennsylvania. Taria agreed to elicit confession out of Eileen in exchange for immunity. And it took her about 3 days to get the confession. And again, this is the only part, you know, Eileen is so in love with Taria and she flips on her. So again, somebody else who's let her down. A year later, it was January 14th of 1992, Warners went on trial for Mallory. On January 27th, she was convicted of the murder with help from Taria's testimony. And at her sentencing, the psychiatrist for the defense testified that she was mentally unstable and had been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder and antisocial personality disorder. 4 days later, they sentenced her to death, refusing to consider or allegedly having considered both of those diagnoses.
That's terrible.
Yeah. Supreme Court ruled that there's not a problem in executing people who have mental, we don't want to say defects. In June of 1992, Warnos pleaded guilty to the murder of Kerskadden. And in 1992, she received her 5th death sentence, at which point you might as well just kind of give up on all of it. So she went back and forth on this documentary where she would, when she thought the cameras weren't there, she said that it was self-defense, and in a couple other cases, it was also self-defense. So there was only one time when I saw her claiming they were all in self-defense. You kind of tend to want to believe that the first one is so that it makes a little bit of sense, but she lied so much, there's no way to know what is and isn't true. So they did an assessment using the psychopathy checklist, and she scored 32 out of 40. It evaluates...
Was that good or bad?
I would guess not great unless you're trying to become a psychopath. Or become...
Ah.
Yeah.
So like the higher the score, the more likely you are kind of a thing?
That's my guess. I don't think it's like points you want more of. And it says it evaluates individuals on a 20-item list of antisocial and interpersonal behaviors... each you score with a 1, 2, or 3. So the maximum you can get is 40. Scores above 25 or 30, consistent with a diagnosis of psychopathy. So, you know, she did good. 25 to 30, she got 32.
She's off the charts.
It's amazing. She's an
I kind of want to take that test.
Yeah, right. She's an overachiever. So her appeal went to the U.S. Supreme Court. It was denied in 1996. In 2001, there was a petition in Florida Supreme Court. She stated her intention to dismiss her legal counsel and terminate all appeals. And she said, quote, "I killed those men." And she wrote, "Robbed them as cold as ice, and I do it again, too. There's no chance in keeping me alive or anything, because I'll kill again. I have hate crawling through my system. I am so sick of hearing this she's crazy stuff. I've been evaluated so many times. I'm competent, sane, and I'm trying to tell the truth. I'm the one who seriously hates human life and would kill again." So.
Wow. Yeah. Well, all right. There you go.
That was the point when she was trying to speed up her execution and get it over with.
Mm.
So, she had...
So, in which case, then, if you're delving into this stuff, it's like, did she... Because you had said before that she was so full of lies. Was this just another one of those lies? It's like, look, I'm just tired of it. I'm done.
It's hard to know. Like, I think even the filmmaker who was doing the documentary, I'm not sure even he knew. Who is left to know her intentions? You know, and the only people who know what happened, they're both dead now. All of them are dead.
Yeah.
Not to let her issues wane, once she was in prison, in 2002, she began accusing the prison matrons of tainting her food with dirt, saliva, and urine. And so she became very paranoid, and she even, quote, "they were wishing to rape me before execution." So she said she couldn't eat her food because it was always tainted, and the one time she had eaten it, she was almost killed. But in the weeks before her execution, she gave a series of interviews to Broomfield, and he was the one who caught her off camera saying that she was indeed attacked on the very first murder, which I guess it would still be murder. She talked about being taken away to meet God and Jesus, and she, I don't know if she legitimately believed it, but she said everyone else was going to hell and she was going to heaven. Now, keep in mind, this woman, when sentenced to death, she began screaming at the judge that she hoped his wife and children all got raped. So she had a little bit of an anger issue.
A little bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, paranoia of you thinking everybody's out to get you, out to attack you.
Right. Yeah. And she said that the sonic pressure, food poisonings, abuse, you know, it went on.
Maybe she really had to worry about that stuff when she was little, you know?
Absolutely.
She didn't have any safe place.
She never did. And I think, you know, at this point, Taria has turned on her. She betrayed her, and that was the last person she had.
Right.
So I can't imagine there was much that she wanted to hang on to. She said, quote, "You sabotaged my ass. Society and the cops and the system. A raped woman got executed and was used for books and movies and shit." And this is where it kind of gets interesting to me. Apparently two officers were dismissed or... Something happened to them because they had entered into contracts with movie rights. They were selling their story in relation to Eileen. And before Taria had gotten Eileen to confess, apparently she was also in talks to sell movie rights on her side. So in that, I think that... The last interview that Eileen gave, the only thing she wanted to do was discuss the cops. And if you didn't want to hear about the cops who had allowed her to continue murdering, so they had something to write about while she cleaned up the streets in the process, this is what she says, then she has nothing left to say. And she quickly concluded that interview, her last interview. She didn't have a last meal. She just had a cup of black coffee. Her execution took place October 9th of 2002. She died at 9:47 a.m. And her last words were, "Yes, I would just like to say I'm sailing with the rock and I'll be back, like Independence Day, with Jesus. June 6th, like the movie, Big Mothership and all, I'll be back, I'll be back." She was the 10th woman in the United States and the second in Florida to be executed since the 1976 Supreme Court decision restoring capital punishment. And that is Eileen Wuornos.
These are just some tortured souls, man. Yeah, it just makes me wonder, you know, where all these folks would be if, you know, they just got a couple more hugs or...
Or she got any. They interviewed her mom in the documentary, and he said, oh, you know, she was abused. And she goes, oh, she wasn't abused, something along these lines. And then when he told her that she was living in the woods, she goes, oh, my goodness, I didn't know that. Like, you fucking cared. You don't drop your kids off with a rapist and take off.
Right.
I don't know.
And so how was Monster? I've never seen it.
It's a really good movie.
I'll have to add that of my... I've seen all the other ones that we've talked about in this episode, but I have not seen Monster or that documentary, so I'm going to add those.
I was able to watch the documentary on AMC streaming. I'm not sure what their app is called. As far as I know, it's not streaming for free anywhere else.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check it out.
Head into the dark web.
There you go. I only get on the dark web when I turn the light off.
Thank you.
Ladies, this was extremely disturbing.
Yeah, I'm gonna have nightmares, so that's cool.
Yeah, I think I did have a nightmare about... but I think it was after the episode where we talked about the butcher... the butcher who skinned alive her hubby or her boyfriend or whatever.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, he was dead when she skinned him.
Oh, right. Right.
Yeah, she stabbed him like 27 times.
They had just got done having sex.
Yeah, I remember that part as well. And then she served his head. I don't mean to do a full recap of that episode. It just really stuck with me.
Yeah, for anybody who hasn't listened, Diane's going to give you a quick recap.
Yeah, that was it. It was just brutal. It was brutal.
Just go listen to the episode. It's a good one.
That's why Anna and Jennifer have done this nerdy nerd series, though, right? Because... I just can't stop thinking about all these creepy things. Thank you so much for having me here.
This is our third episode, so this will be the end of this series for crimes. But I think we may talk about coming back for paranormal.
Okay, I have a question.
Yes.
If you have a particular person on, let's say her name is Schmyann... if you have her on multiple times during your nerd theme or your mini series about things where people are nerds, does that mean she's a super nerd?
If you are, is that a problem? I mean, if Schmyann is.
Well, I guess it doesn't matter, right? Because it's Schmyann and not Diane. So. No problem.
I don't see anything wrong with that at all whatsoever.
I've been present for every nerd episode.
Exactly. We're the nerds that came up with it, so.
Oh my god, I don't think I ever laughed so hard as when you guys both recited the nerd theme at the same time on your first nerd episode. And you guys were talking about Revenge of the Nerds. And you both said it at the same time. I just died.
I don't remember but we do stuff like that all the time.
Oh my gosh. Because you guys let all of the audience like stop and pause and watch the nerd episode.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Or the Revenge of the Nerd movie.
Go watch the movie.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that didn't age well. It sure didn't. Have you watched it recently? Like, seriously. I watched it recently with my husband, and yeah, it did not age well. Like, there was a lot of, like, rapey, creepy kind of stuff going on, and I was just like, I remember that being funny. Like,
yeah, if you're not worried about consent, it's a pretty great movie. However...
Yeah. Oh, geez. Yeah, I haven't watched it since 1992, probably.
It's been a minute, but I can recall a couple scenes where I'm thinking, oh, you're not supposed to do that.
Yeah.
Oh.
But it's still, it was very influential in my growing up. So it has made me the person I am today, whether that's good or not. I don't know.
Well, it made you who you are today, plus consent.
Yes, plus other things. I have learned much more than just that movie. But.
Right.
I mean, the movie was, like, zero consent and titties everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Oh, 1980s titties.
It's been, like, 3 episodes since I've been able to say titties, so I had to squeeze that in there.
Squeeze the titties.
Squeeze the titties right in there. Well, Diane, I hope you will come back and join us on our next Midnight Edition series.
Yeah, I would love to. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming
on. No, it's been great. We love having you here. You give good insights. You ask the right questions.
Like, what color is the nipple belt?
Yeah, exactly.
See? These are the things that people want to know about.
Well, I'd be glad to continue to answer those or ask those questions.
I think it's perfect.
Answer them, too.
Well, what I had heard was we are out of time. Join us for our next episode where we will have Happy Hour with Mike Adams.
Whoop, whoop, Mad Dog Adams.
We'll see you next time.
Visit our website at WIHHW.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, see guest links and information, and some fancy extras. Also, check us out on Facebook at What I Had Heard Was, and Instagram at What I Had Heard. And if you really want to get something off your chest, shoot us an email at whatihadheardwas@gmail.com.